I am Sheen, a scientist, social entrepreneur, Oxford and Cambridge graduate, and you are listening to Dream Girl, my weekly podcast where I chat to incredible women about their journey, career choices, and generally about being awesome.
Hello and welcome to this first episode of the Dream, Girl podcast. Is that what you're calling it?
That is exactly what I'm calling it.
Why have you started a podcast?
Because you told me to.
Why have you actually started a podcast?
Well, the idea of the podcast came from you, to be honest, as in to start a podcast.
Okay.
But the theme of the podcast came from a lot of thinking. And I think, okay, I need to go way back for that. Shall I start?
We've got lots of time.
Perfect.
I've got the next 4 hours of my calendar blocked out for you.
Oh, lovely. So I've been thinking a lot about how I can help, because I like to have an impactful life. And there are a few things that I do care about, but mostly I do care about women empowerment and representation in general. And having been at university, you know, having been at Oxford and Cambridge both, I have been thinking about... I have done a lot of outreach events, especially in STEM, given that I was in STEM. And the common theme is always that, oh, but how is it being a girl in STEM? How is it in your lab being the only girl, which has happened in the past? And it seems to be that a lot of the girls in schools in the UK seem to think that, oh, but I don't know, that there might not be other girls there. It might be weird. And I think that made me think about, okay, how can we change that? Obviously, in terms of girls' education, the problems start, there are so many different problems at different stages. You have socioeconomic factors when it comes to education. But these things are more systemic, and it's a bit harder to do to make a change for me, especially there. So I thought, okay, how can I make an impact? And then I started reflecting about what inspired me to do what I do. And obviously, there are the famous women of history, and you always look to role models, and these can be people in your life or they can be famous people. But I think as a girl, you do want to see women role models, because you can relate with their experience. And then thinking a bit about my friends, I realized that all of my friends are doing so many different things, and the conversations are always super, super cool about, okay, how did you get into that? And why did you think of this? What were the barriers? Did you not think, oh, are you going to be the first girl to do this? And these conversations are always really, really interesting. And that's when I thought, okay, I wish I could share this with everyone else, so everyone else could have a peek into, okay, you don't need to just do conventional stuff. Everyone is doing really cool and creative things now, whether they're boys or girls, you, for example. But I think for women, because we are actively trying to bridge that gap, it's really cool that if I could just share these conversations with everyone else. And that's why I decided that the podcast could be doing that exactly, you know, just having conversations with different girls and women who are doing very, very different things in their lives.
Interesting. Why would you start a podcast, given that, I mean, surely there are other podcasts in this sort of genre interviewing sort of successful women in various domains?
Yes, there are quite a few podcasts interviewing successful women, but they're usually quite famous women as well. So you'll get the likes of Michelle Obama, who has a podcast now. And I think sometimes this can be harder to relate to, because they might have had very different experiences, very different paths to success. And even me, just listening to Michelle Obama podcast, I love her and I think her podcast is really cool, but none of it is relatable. And even Ellen DeGeneres, I think she's really cool, but not relatable. Which is funny, because her Netflix special is called Relatable.
No, okay.
but I think that's probably what I thought would be a little bit different, because I'm just bringing in people who are very relatable, who've had very normal lives, and they're just trying to do their best based on what they have, and just, you know, having dreams, which I think everyone has, but a bit more relatable in the sense of the reality of things.
Okay. And so it's interesting that you say that you're sort of on the lookout for female role models, mm-hmm. because, like, as a dude,
mm-hmm.
I just, in a way, I don't even think about the gender of my role models.
I know.
And it just so happens that all of them are men. And I feel like one of those white people who says that they're kind of they don't see color.
Mm-hmm.
I guess as a guy, you just don't even consider that, yeah, I want a male role model, because in a way, I wouldn't even I wouldn't even consider, I can't think of a single woman who I would consider an actual role model.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, why is that?
But what, why do you think? I mean, okay, so if we take one of your role models, for example, is there any other woman who's doing the same thing in the same area?
Not especially.
So that we see, we narrow down on one of the problems there, because statistics keep showing how, you know, the higher you go, the representation of women go down. So in hierarchies, in different careers, different industries. So one of the reasons might be that there isn't a woman role model in the area that you're looking for.
Hmm.
But I also think you relate more to the male role models, which is why, you know, you can relate with a lot of things, that whether the banter or just, you know, the way they dress, you can replicate that. You know how sometimes you'll be like, oh, what they're wearing is cool. So it's a bit like that. That's why I think even for young girls I'll give you a concrete example. So we did one of these outreach events in Cambridge, and it's called Physics at Work. And you invite loads of girls from different schools that come over, trying to convince them that, you know, science is cool. And we have loads of girls that do it. You should do it.
Mm-hmm.
But then a lot of the volunteers seem to be men who help. And then, I mean, obviously they're very like passionate. They want to help. They care about outreach. That's why they're there, to help. But I don't think it really helps, because at the end of the day, you when you talk to the girls at the exit survey kind of thing, they're all like, yeah, but it's still physics. And I didn't see a lot of girls that were there to talk about their experience doing physics. So you see that even though there is an active effort trying to tell them that you're welcome here, but if it's not a girl telling them that, they still feel like, oh, but it's the other people, you know, and they are trying to welcome us, but they don't relate to us. They won't be able to, they don't understand what we need, or they don't understand how we will fit in. But if a girl is like, I was the same as you, and I've applied, and now I'm doing physics, and this is what my life is like, and it's totally fine being a girl here because no one cares, then they listen, you know?
Interesting.
Yeah. It's about shared experiences, and I think everyone can relate to that.
Okay. Yeah, that seems very reasonable. Mm. So what sort of guests are you looking to get over time?
Well, that's very interesting. So at the moment, I'm obviously just reaching out to friends, because I think my friends are really cool. But also, I think eventually I would like to branch out. What I'm hoping for is just a variety of careers and showing the wide breadth of things that people are doing, whether it is different industries or different kind of career progressions, whether it is self-employed or the traditional routes of going into banking or medicine, but also just crazy things, just to show that, you know, women are basically almost everywhere now. So it's just about getting a breadth of things, and I know that from my own network of people I won't have everyone, so eventually I would like to reach out to more interesting people, and then maybe even if it is famous people at some point doing really interesting things, then that would be great.
How do you define interesting things?
Okay.
Would, for example, a mother working part-time as a doctor and spending the rest of the time with her kids be counted as interesting in your book?
It depends, right? Okay, that's a very good example. I think there, what you could learn from that person is how they manage their time and how they juggle different things at the same time. And it's also because I think being a mother and a carer is a full-time job in itself. So therefore, how do they balance being that and a doctor at the same time, which is also a very demanding job.
Mm.
And I think that even if it's not interesting directly to me or something that I can't relate with, but some people in the audience might be interested in that. They might be people who are also trying to juggle two different things, or they're trying to go part-time so that they can also look after their kids. So it's just about whether it will bring something new to the conversation, or just, you know, bring a new insight.
Okay, so it sounds like kind of if you can identify people who are doing something in which their opinion would be useful to the listeners, plus or minus they've got some kind of unconventional career path that maybe women as a whole don't go into, then that would be the sort of person you would want to have on your podcast.
Yes, sure. But also the conventional ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just like any woman doing anything, basically, can be a guest.
I suppose so, because I do think that everyone has something about whether their path, their journey to where they are or where they want to go. Everyone has something unique about themselves. It's just about trying to find it.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. What about you? What's your story, as they say?
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, it was a sunny day I'm not going to say the year. I was born in Mauritius.
Why not?
Well, fine.
Isn't that a social construct?
Basically. Okay, fine. Back in 1992, I was born in Mauritius, brought up there. I left when I was 18. I came to Oxford to do material science for 4 years. And then after that, I took a year out, went back home, chilled a bit, and then I came back to Cambridge to do a PhD in back pain research. And throughout my 8 years now in education, it's been very, very interesting. In my undergrad, I just learned a lot about steel, which I wish I didn't. But in my extra time, I think I've made the best use I could of being in Oxford and Cambridge, which I think has been really interesting. Again, I know, weird use of the weird word. But okay, so what I've done is, as I said, I'm interested in quite a few things. And the things that I'm mostly interested are usually like access to education in general, and then women empowerment, and also the refugee crisis. And I've done a few things with these, dabbled a bit. I've set up a charity called Project Access for Refugees. I've done a few other outreach events. I have also set up recently during COVID-19, set up Reshape Co, which is a pro bono consulting service. So what I've done, I think, is I've tried to think about the skills that I would want to have at the end of my degree, which would not just be related to the degree, and think about what ways I could learn these and how could I enrich, you know, my network and just generally the things that I know. And yeah, so now I'm done with the PhD and I'm looking into going into life science consulting. But yeah, you could ask me for more targeted questions if you want.
What does women empowerment mean?
Oh gosh. Okay, so I think when we say women empowerment, people usually understand economic empowerment or like financial empowerment. But it's not just that. I think it is trying to give women the chance to have an opinion when decisions are taken, especially about them, which is why now there's like this whole riot happening. I forgot which country it is, because they've decided to make abortion illegal, and women are like, but why are men deciding this? Because there's no women on that panel that is deciding this. So it's a bit of like, okay, it's about our body, why is someone else deciding it? But I think women empowerment in general, as I said, is giving a voice to women and letting them also have a say in decisions that are being taken. I know you think this is weird, but, you know, like, I was just reading about this woman who in 1967, which isn't that far ago, she forced herself into the Boston Marathon, and she was the first woman to run a marathon, and they were physically trying to remove her from the marathon because women are not allowed to run. But thanks to her, the next year they changed the laws and then women were allowed to run in marathons. And this seems like it was so recent, and it's crazy to think that, okay, just a few years ago, women were not allowed to do this. They were not allowed to vote. They were not allowed to go to work. They weren't allowed to make decisions. So it's just about trying to change this. And obviously we are in England where these things are not as pronounced. Therefore, you don't feel like we're still in those days. But many women across the globe are still under this kind of old regulations. And I think women empowerment takes different forms depending on where you are. That's why it's like in Europe, women empowerment means different things. It means having a choice to do things. In other places, it just means changing the actual laws. So it really varies. And I think different women have different definitions of women empowerment, which is not necessarily a bad thing.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And you mentioned that another one of your interests is the refugee crisis.
Yeah.
What's the deal with the refugee crisis? And how does it work, and how what's your interest in it?
So my interest in it started because, as I said, I'm from Mauritius, and for us to get our independence from the British Empire back in 1968, we had to give up one of the islands that we owned, which is called the Chagos Islands. And just one day, they just decided to ship everyone there to Mauritius, and the island now belongs to the UK. And there is a big, it's still the case till now. And I think last year the UN ruled that England should give us back this island. But they're still like, well, we have a fort there. We don't think it's livable anymore, etc. They really don't want to give it back. But these people since then have lived like refugees in Mauritius. And the problem is they're not considered Mauritians. So they are not registered. They're not allowed to work. They don't get proper jobs. So they are on like governmental benefits. So they are refugees in the country because they had to leave everything behind. And then when we were in schools, we used to go to these like camps where they live and try to help them out, you know, try to talk to the other kids, see how we could help. And then it baffled me how this is possible that some people just decide, okay, you leave your home and go. And that's when I started being a bit more interested into the refugee crisis. I looked a bit more into it. And obviously when we say refugee crisis, it's a very, very broad bracket. There are different kind of refugees. You have political refugees, you have all kinds from different countries. And then when I got to Cambridge, I got involved with, they have this group of people that the staff of Cambridge organizes. They're called the Cambridge Convoy. And they send people on a monthly basis to Calais to just help out. I've been a few times. You literally just go and go into the kitchen and chop up vegetables and cook. And then this food is being sent to the refugees that are in Calais. And then again, I thought, okay, this is helpful to like be like hands, you know, for them. But I also wanted to like, okay, how do we stop this? Why is nobody like finding a solution to this? Because these people are just stranded. And then you keep seeing in the news that, you know, they're dying on boats, etc. And but obviously, again, it's the limitation of what can I do that would actually have an impact, even if it's on one person's life. And that's when I thought I was involved in Project Access then, which just helps underprivileged kids from across the world to get into university. And then I had a chat with them and I said, okay, you don't cater specifically for refugees. How about we have a special branch that just help the refugees. And through that, I got to work with so many of the volunteers in London, especially because they have all these like after school where teachers go to the refugee camps to help these kids and try to get them to get good grades, etc. And this has been quite useful. And we did manage to help 6 of them get into university. And the reason they don't usually go to university is because they don't know how to apply, first of all. Because they do get the grades most often. And secondly, they don't know that because they don't qualify for home fees and they can't afford for the international fees. And then, but they don't know that many universities have grants and scholarships that are specifically for refugees. So it's about just, you know, redirecting them and showing them what is available to them and helping them through the process. And that helped so many kids. And I thought, okay, that's one way of helping. And then another thing that I also did was with this global health think tank, and they wanted policies to be published, and I worked on publishing this paper on mental health of refugees in the UK. And again, this was really interesting because we got to interview quite a lot of people and talk to them about, because mental health is a problem for everybody. Now imagine being forced to leave your home as well, whether you're a kid or an adult or an older person. It's just so much strain. And that's how we talked to them, and we realized that the problem at the moment is the screening is done only for adults, so older than 18 year olds. So all the kids, their mental health is not considered at all when they get into the UK, and older people are also not considered. So we did eventually manage to publish a policy brief on this. And our recommendation was that you should look at different ages and also their needs, and the treatment that they need is completely different. So you should not just bracket everybody together. So yeah, that's kind of my experience with the refugee sphere.
It sounds like you care a lot about kind of the impact you're having.
Yes.
So when you're kind of planning your life kind of for the future, to what extent does impact tie up with other things, like the stuff that you personally enjoy versus the stuff that's going to make money versus stuff that's good for the environment? Like how do you square impact against these other factors?
Okay, so that's where effective altruism comes in. So it's about that, you know, you don't need to just be a volunteer or working for a charity or an NGO to be having impact and helping the world. Helping the world doesn't equate to not making money. But So effective altruism, what it's telling you is whatever industry you're in, whatever career you're interested in, whatever training you've had, you can still make a difference. And obviously, the most obvious way of doing this is to just give money. If you're earning a lot of money, give money. But other ways of doing this is just using your network or the skills that you have, and then trying to figure out how could this have an impact. And that's what I've been trying to do, because obviously, you know, I would like to have a good job where it pays well, but I would also like to think that I would still care about what I'm doing. So for example, with consultancy, you do get a lot of pro bono cases, you do get a lot of social impact cases, and there are companies that solely work on social impact consultancy. So I think wherever you are, obviously being a doctor is the easiest example, but wherever you are, I think whatever job you're doing, there is a way of making impact. And if you don't, you don't see how you could make impact through your job, which I think is quite hard, then there is always, you know, you could volunteer your time, you could give money. But I do, to answer your question in a very roundabout way, is that I do want to plan my life in a way where I can also satisfy the needs that I have in my head and the requirements I have in terms of a career, but also make sure that the impact that I'm having is good enough for me.
What do you mean by good enough for you?
As in, I'm satisfied with it. I can go to bed happy knowing that I have tried my best to have an impact, you know?
So is this the sort of thing that you would quantify in terms of number of lives saved or number of like disability adjusted life years added, or is it more of a sort of subjective assessment? Because, you know, you mentioned effective altruism, and one of the things that, at least from the reading I've done about it, is that there are some charities, you know, that are less effective than others. Mm-hmm. But for example, it feels good and helps you sleep at night to mm-hmm. donate to Save the Children when they ask for donations on the street.
Yeah.
But if you were to donate to the Against Malaria Foundation, you could probably save like a whole life for like £2,000.
Mm-hmm.
But for most people, that wouldn't help them sleep any better at night because it's so far removed from kind of our reality, at least living in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So what's your, do you have a way of quantifying your impact, or do you not really think about it in those terms?
Oh, I have thought about it quite a lot, especially because the charities I've worked in, we tried to quantify the impact that we have. And it is so hard when it comes to social work. I actually worked with the City Council in Cambridge because they wanted to quantify the help they're giving to homeless people in Cambridge. And it is so hard to do because you can easily say, we'll count it as the number of lives changed. But that doesn't necessarily happen in the time frame that you want it to happen. So I agree with you. It is very arbitrary. Like, some people care about just, you know, I have done my bit. Mm. These people will take care of it. Or do I actually care about where does the money go? What's the end product? So for me, as I said, you know, even with like the educational charity thing, it was more about seeing the impact. So even for me, even if it only helped one student get into university, that would have been good enough. Because I know you said it's far removed for you because you're in the UK, but I grew up in an African country. I know what it looks like. I've been to the refugee camps. I know what it looks like. And I feel like just knowing that this is how this one person's life will change, I think it's good enough, especially with the refugees. You know that once one of them is educated, the whole rest of their generations, their life changes completely from being stuck in the refugee camp to being able to have a house. And that's for me is already impactful. So I don't like just donating without knowing what happened. So for example, the malaria thing, I think that's a very good one because after you've donated, they also show you the people who got your money and this is what happened. And there are other charities where they will show you the exact well, for example, that was built from your money. So it's just actually knowing what your input is, whether it's financial or not. If it has changed even one person's life, for me, that's enough. I don't care about quantity. It's just about the quality.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Changing gears just a little bit. So it's 2020.
Yeah.
You're living in the UK. Your family is wealthy enough to be able to afford international fees at universities like Oxford and Cambridge. Mm-hmm. But you are a woman and you're a woman of color.
Yeah.
So what are some of the challenges associated with that.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay. Very interesting question. There are challenges, yes, unfortunately. And obviously, being a woman of color is just like two things. Okay, so there are two ways that you feel it. The first one is microaggressions. I don't know if you've heard this term before. Probably.
Oh, many times.
Yeah.
But I'm curious about your experience with this, because you seem generally fairly chilled out. And my general, maybe this says a lot about me, but my general sort of understanding of the term microaggression is, it would be like someone asking you where you're from, and someone would take that, oh, they're only asking me where I'm from because I look brown.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if someone asked me where I'm from, I'd be like, oh, well, I was born in Pakistan, I've been mm-hmm. here. It just wouldn't even register as like being an issue.
Uh-huh.
So what do you mean when you say microaggressions?
Okay, so I actually wrote a blog about this, about the whole where are you from.
Okay.
And I think, okay, I agree with you. Sometimes some people just want to know where you're from. You know, they just want to have a conversation, have something that they understand about you. And I think that's totally fair to say, okay, I am from this place. But then sometimes you can see that after I've said, for example, I'm from Mauritius, then in their head, they're like, okay, but that's Africa. You don't look African. And then they don't know how to ask this. And I wish they would just say, okay, but you're brown. Where does the brown skin come from? Because that's exactly what they're thinking. But then they'll be like, no, but where are you actually from? And that's what really bugs me, where it's just a bit like, no, but you're lying now. You're just trying to be someone else, because it looks like they're trying to tell you no, but you're covering up where you really are from. And this usually comes from wrong wording of the question, because I think sometimes the intentions are fine, but they just don't know how to ask it without offending. And I think secondly, sometimes it is a bit of, no, but I can tell better than you that your brown skin is, you're from India. And I've had so many times this question of, no, but you're brown, are you from India? And then I have to say, no, I am not. Originally, probably we are from India, but we don't know this because it's been at least 10 generations and we've completely lost it. And our ancestors who were brought to Mauritius were indentured laborers, and we don't know who they were. We completely don't know. And for me, I am fully Mauritian, and for someone else to be like, no, but you must be Indian, is a bit of like, but why are you reducing my identity to what you think is correct based on the color of my skin? I think when someone says something, you should just take it at face. And I think that that's one of the, I don't think that's microaggression, though. I think that's quite aggressive. Huh? And I think the microaggressions are things that you just cannot describe. So my friend wrote an article about this, and I thought this was really interesting. So she is a black woman, and she went to a yoga class, and she rolled out her mat, and the woman next to her was just doing her stretching, and she didn't notice her at first. And then she turned and saw her, and she just moved her yoga mat a little bit further. And that just shows that it's really hard to explain without sounding like it's all in your head, but you as the person, as the victim of this microaggression, you know that this is because they saw who you are and they're like, okay, just a bit further. And they might not be doing it actively, but it is something's in their head that happens. And then sometimes when you're in social settings, there are some looks, there are some things, and I can see your face right now. You're just not convinced by this. And that's the whole point of microaggressions, is that you cannot explain it to someone else without sounding like you're overthinking it. You know?
Yeah, this is always the issue, because in the yoga example, you know, it's COVID time.
It wasn't COVID time. It was 4 years ago.
Okay, fine. It's 4 years ago, and someone's like, oh, well, you know, I'll just give this person a bit more space. Like, why would you choose to interpret that as
no,
like,
but she was fine when the mat was, she saw the mat. She didn't see the person on the mat. And then when she saw the person on the mat, she moved.
And the person on the mat is thinking, okay, the reason must be because of the color of my skin, rather than because she just wanted to give me some space.
Yeah.
Okay.
But also, you know, this assessment of microaggressions come from when you experience it several times.
Okay.
Then you start to notice. And like for you, now it sounds completely irrational. You're like, okay, maybe, you know, give her benefit of the doubt. But when you experience it over and over again, like, for example, sitting in a bus and then the person next to you moves or things like that, then you might say, oh, the person just didn't want to sit to someone else. But when it happens to you over and over again, things that don't happen to other people, you know that this is because of you.
Hmm. Interesting. Okay. So what about you personally?
okay, me personally, I think to give you an example, I know I'm trying to say women in STEM is fine, but I went to this conference, which was for spinal surgeons, and at the banquet dinner, you are grouped in smaller groups, you have smaller rounded tables, and there was this surgeon who was on the table, same as me, and he was asking everyone, you know, what's your PhD in? Where do you want to go in the future? And then he got to me and he was like, don't you think you should just become a teacher, though, like a school teacher? Because how are you going to manage having a family life with everything else? And I was like, but why did you not suggest this to this guy who is doing exactly the same thing as me? He was like, no, but it's the woman's role to look after the kids. And then that's a bit of like, okay, like, why? Where does this come from? And then he kept going on being like, you know, and he is brown. And then he started using the, but in our culture. And I was like, first of all, you don't even know what my culture is. You're just assuming that we have the same culture because we have the same color, skin color. And then he was like, in our culture, it is the woman's role. So I think you should really rethink this. And also, I don't know why you did a PhD, but I feel like the higher educated you are, the smaller your pool is for a potential husband, because, you know, you don't want to emasculate your husband. And so these things come up, and this is not someone who is uneducated or anything. This is a surgeon, and he works with a team of female surgeons as well. But you do get these questions, and then you're baffled. You're like, I don't know what to explain to you. Like, if you were someone who is not exposed to this, usually I could be like, okay, but you don't know how things are, but you do work with women who are even more qualified than you are, but you still think that. And then it's a bit of like, I'm at a loss. I don't know how to deal with that. And you're just like, okay, let's move on. So this is like one example of something quite in your face, where people see you like that. And then another thing, which everyone seemed to think is really funny, but in my department, there are only two brown girls, me and Malavika, who's actually going to be a guest in the podcast. And we are very, very different in the way we look. I'm taller than her. She has got really short hair. I've got really long hair. And people confuse us to be the same person all the time. There was this this lecturer competition that Malavika took part in, and I went to support because we are friends. And this lady came up to me being like, you did such a great job, congratulations. I was like, I didn't take part. She was like, did you win? I said, no, I didn't. Malavika won, and she won the first prize. She was like, oh, but you did such a great job. How did they not give it to you? I was like, it was not me. This is crazy. And then, like, you get things like people interviewing her and giving her things that she interviewed for, and then coming up to me and congratulating me the next day. And I was like, you did the interview yesterday with her. We look nothing alike. And this has become a joke in the department, but at the same time, it's a bit like, okay, do you really not see past the skin color? Because we look absolutely different, except that we're both brown. And I guess we're both quite chatty, but very different. And it just baffles me how people still confuse us to be the same person. And again, it's just because we are the two women of color in the department.
Interesting. Yeah, those experiences, like with that surgeon example, I guess, like, what goes through your head at that moment?
I'm just in shock. Seriously, that surgeon, yeah. I was like, is he seriously saying that?
Okay.
And then it went from bad to worse. Then he went to, but I married a white woman, but I still managed to convert her and made her stay at home to look after the children. And I was like, what is happening? This is just a mad conversation. You just don't know what to do. You just have to laugh sometimes and just be like, okay, lost cause. Because how am I going to convince him? He's not someone who's going to change his mind. He's just going to keep telling me that I am wrong. So.
Okay. Yeah, because I guess in one of those, because like there's a part of me that wants to say, yeah, well, if you experience these microaggressions, why don't you just bring it up? But I guess that's very easy to say kind of after the fact, and when you're in a social event and
exactly,
and you know, the conversation is moving on. At that point, you probably don't want to choose that point to make a stance.
Yeah.
You're like, no, Mr. Surgeon, Mr. Consultant, I disagree with you because you are backwards and whatever you want to say to him.
Exactly. And then sometimes you're in situations where it's someone who, you know, you work with who is higher up than you, and then you don't want to just, you know, to like rub them the wrong way just because of something that you can't even explain that well. And you know that no one else will back you up on this because no one else has experienced it. Like, oh, maybe you're overthinking it. And then you're just like, okay, well, let's just hope for a better world.
Let's hope these people die out quickly.
Yeah.
And the more woke people can take their place.
Exactly.
And do you consider yourself woke?
I don't know what that means, to be honest.
I know me neither, that's why I asked.
I think the word has become quite common, but I don't know what it means. I understand what people mean by it, but I think different people have different meanings of woke. And the very definition of woke is someone who is accepting, right? And you do understand that everyone is different from you and you should respect that and you should not have a say in how other people lead their lives. And I think that meaning, I'm happy with that. And I think I can call myself woke if that's what woke means. But I also think some woke peoples have very like strong feelings about things, which then I don't understand how they reconciliate that with being woke. Like, for example, the whole cancel culture that goes on social media. It's usually the woke people who are like, cancel these people, they're doing this wrong or something. I understand if it's something racist or sexist that they've said, but if it's just a different opinion, sometimes it's a bit like, but you're meant to be
an opinion that my opinion is that the women should stay in the house and raise the kids.
Yeah, but that's not okay.
Okay, well, that's not okay because...
Because that's you assuming that women are inferior to you.
No, it's not. It's assuming that women have... That different genders have different roles.
Yeah, but why do you decide what the other gender does? It would be different if you were just saying, I'm the man and I should be the one making money. It's different to saying, I'm a man, I'm going to decide that you're a woman and you need to stay at home. Do you see the difference?
I see the difference, but I think the thing that I'm trying to get at is...
It's still an opinion, you mean?
Yes, it's still an opinion. Like, you're saying, I don't understand when woke people... It seems like you're saying, if your opinion is racist or sexist, then it's okay to be cancelled. But if it's another kind of opinion, then it's not okay to be cancelled.
Yes. So, okay, but I didn't
like so many. There are so many variants of isms that yes. Any opinion that you had is... could well be offensive to someone out there.
I agree.
So how do you think about that?
But I think being offensive is different to it, like diminishing someone else's identity, you know, like being offensive is different, right? For example, you can say that, oh my God, what are you wearing? This is disgusting. People who wear this are disgusting. You're offending that person's taste in clothing, for example.
Okay.
That's different to when you are treating other people as being beneath you. But again, people who are racist or sexist, again, for me, the cancel culture is just not right because, you know, again, it's the thing about I don't want to judge someone else. And sometimes when it comes to even, you know, with the Black Lives Matter, people were just canceling others because they did something wrong when trying to become allies to the whole movement. Then it's a bit of like, okay, but give them benefit of the doubt. Try to understand where they're coming from, because they're not outright saying I am against black people. They're just trying and failing by trying to show support. They're doing something that's slightly wrong. So that's where I think being woke doesn't add up to that, because you're just canceling people because they're not doing things the way you want them to do things. But that doesn't really come into the whole sexism and racism, because some things are just not acceptable, right? It's just like, we know slavery was wrong. We know being racist is wrong. We know being sexist is wrong. And this is generally according to the social moral, this is wrong. And these things are just wrong. I don't think that's debatable, really. So that's different to the cancel culture. I mix them up. I apologize. But what I was trying to say is, don't just cancel people because the way they express their opinion is different to yours.
Okay, that seems...
Yeah.
Fair. Do you consider yourself a feminist?
Oh gosh, again, another question. So the definition of being a feminist is so different to different people. And I think Emma Watson has addressed this several times, because she considers herself as a feminist. And then she posted some pictures of her without clothes on and people attacked her being like, you're a feminist, why are you doing this? And she said, why do some women use feminists as the rod to beat out other women who are not behaving like they want them to behave? So that's when things get a bit... Okay, but being a feminist just means that, you know, you support other women and you're all working towards bridging the gaps in everything, right? Whether it is representation or the wage gap, anything. But it also means that you do not judge other women. And this is something I think that's a bit missing in being a feminist, because then feminists sometimes judge women who decide to stay at home and look after their children. They're like, you're not part of the rally. We don't want to stay at home. We want to work. And that's when it gets a bit weird. And also just like the case with Emma Watson, where they're like, why are you showing off your body? This is what society has shown you, etc. But again, this is her choice. So it's about understanding that women have a choice and we're fighting to have that choice. So let's just support each other in having the choice. And at the end of the day, everyone does what they want. And this is what I believe in. And I don't know if that falls under being a feminist or not.
Okay, I have another question. To what extent do you believe in equality of opportunity versus equality of outcome? To use the standard buzzwords.
Oh my goodness, explain these first.
Okay, so equality of opportunity would be that everyone should have an equal chance to get where they are. Like, mm-hmm. You know, we should remove the artificial barriers that are in place that are stopping women or black people, or insert a category of people here. Remove the artificial barriers that are stopping them from doing stuff. So, mm-hmm. for example, saying women can't vote is not equality of opportunity, because you're literally just not giving them the opportunity to
right.
vote. Equality of outcome, on the other hand, is saying that, well, given that women make about 50% of the population, we would expect women to make up 50% of CEOs as well. Mm-hmm. And if they're not, if they're only, let's say, 10% of CEOs, or even 5% or even 1% of CEOs, mm-hmm. then that is evidence of a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's equality of outcome.
Okay. But those are two very different things, right?
They are, yeah. Some people believe in one but not the other, and some people believe in both.
I feel like we need a bit of both. Mm. Because, so I came across this this experiment that a teacher did with the students, because this school was facing a lot of racism. So he got all of the students to stand in one line and he said, I will say something, and if this is something you have experienced in your life, take a step forward. And then he would ask things like, have your family ever been on benefits? Have you had free meals, etc.? And then you would see all of the black kids, for example, were just at the back, and then these just kept moving forward. And then at the end of the experiment, he was like, okay, all of the people who are forward, now turn around and look at the people who are behind. He said, they are now there, and this is how life works. So now you are starting from where you are in the race of life, and these people are starting way behind you. And if I give you the same opportunity, they cannot catch up because of this distance that you have already taken from them. Mm. So that's why I don't know if this kind of agrees with your opportunity thing. So you are saying removing the artificial barriers. I don't know what that means. How does that relate into reality? But if you don't bridge the gap first, you are not giving them the same opportunity. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
You need. So I believe that the best way to help is to make everyone start from the same starting line, rather than, you know, making allowances. I know that people hate it when you like just have a quota, you know, let's have like 50% women in the job, because then it's a bit of like, okay, but there might have been men that were more qualified than the women, which is true. But then if all girls were given the same starting position as the boys, and then you don't need a quota, because then it's the best qualified person. And I think that's how it should be. But everyone should be starting at the same position, then mm-hmm. it would make it fairer, and then you don't need to have quotas for representation. But in terms of the outcome, this is still a massive problem. We were just talking about this. So in my research lab, the two people at the top, the two professors, are two women. And this is very, very rare. In the whole department, this doesn't happen. And one of them is now the head of the department, and one of them is a commander of the Queen. So she's really cool.
Commander of the Queen?
Yeah. You know, when you get those awards from the Queen.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay.
Yeah,
nice.
So like being a lord or something. She's now Commander Best.
And it's
like, okay. So they've done really well in their fields, and now they're at the top. So I was talking to one of them, who's now the head of the department, and I asked, okay, how do you feel being the head of the department? She was like, it's crazy because it doesn't happen. And when she goes to the meetings of all the head of departments in the university, there are so few women. And she said, I don't understand it, because in our group, for example, there are more girls than boys. And she said, girls are so interested in research, we are everywhere now, but where do they go? Why are they not at the top? And that's when you look at the statistics, and the representation of women just dwindles as you go up. And then some people might say that, okay, but that might be because women are not going for higher positions because they don't want the commitment. But it could be one factor, but there are many other factors. And that's why, you know, with the outcome thing, we do need equality of outcome. But this will only happen when we do, again, make the playing fields equal. So if the same number of women and men are entering, for example, a job at the starting line, and then as they go up, if the same kind of, if there's no preferential treatment is what I'm trying to say, and there's no like taking into account, okay, maybe this woman has 5 children, I don't know how well she would be as a co-head because she might not have the time, she usually has to go to dentist and school pickups, so maybe we should give it to the man. If these things don't happen, then the outcome would be fine. And then if the best qualified candidate is getting it, then great. But I do think it's so many systemic changes that need to happen. It's really hard to say what is the best approach to this.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So do you think, as a loaded question, do you think if 50% of CEOs aren't women, that is evidence of a problem?
Evidence of a problem, yes, but the reasons for that problem can be very diverse, I think. You can't just say that the problem is caused by one single thing. It can be, as I said, it can be a mix of everything. It could be women not going for higher positions because they don't think that they would do well. It could be biased against women, so where they don't think women would do well in a position of leadership. Mm. It could also be that women are not getting the right kind of training and mentoring where then they can take on leadership roles. And it could be a reason that in that area, in that field, women are not generally, like, they don't feel comfortable going into that. So it can be so many things. It's really hard to make one conclusion based on this, but I would still say that it is an indication that there is something off happening, because especially in today's time, if we're just thinking about the UK, I think women are very, very like eager to perform well. Women are reaching out, trying to get as many opportunities as they can. And when we're thinking about CEOs and stuff, many women are now educated, and education is almost 50-50 in gender. So there must be something else at play.
To what extent do you think personal preference is at play here?
To be honest, it's hard to say, but I was part of this thing called Rising WISE, which is WISE stands for Women in Science and Engineering. And they invited, it's like a 3-weekend thing where you go and you all stay together, and they invite all of these women from different industries to come talk to you. And they're usually quite high up. And I was very impressed by the number of women CEOs that you would get from different things. You had like a female registrar, you had a female CEO of this company. And it was really interesting to talk to them, because obviously the first question that comes up is, how is it being a women CEO? How is it being the woman in charge of this whole company? And the one thing that you get a lot is, oh, it wasn't an easy journey. And we had to fight a lot. There is a lot of struggle to get there, which I think happens to everyone who tries to get to the top of something. But at the same time, there was never, because these women made it, I suppose, there was never a lack of motivation. There was never a lack of, I didn't know if I wanted this. It was always, I knew I wanted this and I fought for it. But it might be a skewed focus group to base myself on, because they are clearly people who wanted it and got it. So I don't know when it comes to the other women whether personal preference plays a role or not. But I would like to think that it does play a role, but I don't think it is. It's a minimal role in the problem.
Do you think it's problematic that only 50% do you think it's problematic that if you look at the population of nurses, it's not 50% male female?
It's mostly women, right? What do you mean by is it problematic?
I want to push back against your thing, your stance that if there is not a 50-50 divide in field X, then that is evidence of something being off or some kind of problem.
Oh, but with the nurses, for example, there is a problem there.
Okay, what's that?
It's because the nurse's job has historically been a female job. Mm. And even now, men who are being nurses, they do get a lot of the jokes. Do you wear a miniskirt? Because it is still considered as a traditionally female job.
Okay.
You get that with like pre-primary school teachers as well. Yeah. So then it is considered as a woman's job. So then you have fewer men who are willing to do these kind of jobs because they think, okay, maybe that's not for me. So that's a different side of the problem where now there are jobs that were created for women back then. And now, because we know that, you know, you don't need to be a specific gender to do a job better than the other. So I don't see why a male nurse would be worse than a female nurse. So it's a different kind of problem where it's still that stigma or that kind of this job is too beneath a man to do it. And I think that's where the problem comes from.
Okay. As a sort of follow-up to that then.
Sure.
Do you think that if you took the average man and the average woman, they would both be equally, they would score equally on measures of caringness and empathy?
Well, I know where you're trying to get at with this.
Because the data would say absolutely not.
Yeah, I know what you're trying to get at with that. Okay. Yes, I agree.
Okay.
But then does that mean that a male nurse would not care about their patients as much as a female nurse?
Absolutely not. But I'd say, I think it's important, at least the way I think about this, is important to think about, okay, when we're talking at the population level versus when we're talking about individual cases.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking at the population level, we're saying that broadly 98% of nurses are women.
Yeah.
When we're talking at individual cases, then yeah, sure, of course, like a male nurse is no worse than his female colleagues, but in general, if women have a general predisposition towards being more caring and empathetic, it would make sense for women to be more drawn to fields, all other things being equal, more drawn to fields where it has a more kind of caring and empathetic role. In general, if you look at the population of men versus women, men are generally more interested in systems and in things. Women in general, broadly generalizing, are more interested in people. You would expect there, therefore, at the population level to be some, at least some skew towards men being interested in the systemic such thingsy things and women to be more interested in the people things. One issue that I have not yet been able to find a kind of compelling left-wing argument for is this idea of small differences at the mean leading to large differences at the extremes.
Okay.
For example, if men were on average slightly more aggressive than women, and then so you know, just like very, very slightly, like the average man is just slightly more aggressive than the average woman.
Sure.
At the extreme, if you take the top 0.001% of aggressive people, all of them are going to be men because of that slight shifting of average that you've got at the mean.
Right.
And so that explains why basically everyone in prison is a guy. Does it also explain why basically everyone who's a CEO is a guy? Because men are very slightly more conscientious or more aggressive or more like out to get what they want and very slightly have a preference towards, hey, I'm going to go after this at the expense of my family life. Whereas women in general, very slightly skewed towards actually, I want a more balanced and healthy and wholesome life.
Yeah.
Is that reasonable?
Yes. And to back that up, I have read this other study where what they did was they got a girl and a boy who had the exact same education, same experience. They got them to write their CVs. And then when you compare these two CVs, you will think that the girl is underqualified for the job and the boy is overqualified for the job. And it's just because of the way they sell themselves, right? Girls tend to be a bit more careful about the wording. They don't want to overstate what they've done. They want to like minimize themselves, take less space. And where does this come from? This also comes from, you know, what society teaches you from a very young age. Because when, for example, myself in school, when I used to talk a lot and stuff, I would be called bossy. I would never be called as someone who's assertive. You know, you'd be called, oh, she's a bit bossy. And that's not what they would say for a boy. They would say, oh, this guy knows what he wants. He goes out for it. And again, this has a bit of societal influence on this. It's not just gender-based. The gender roles do come from what society perceives and what you absorb as a kid when you grow up, things that you're not even aware that you do absorb. So yes, then it might mean that when you're going for a job as a woman as compared to a man, you're a bit more careful, you are more hesitant, you might not believe that you will get it, but a man will be like, oh, I'll just try it, you know, who knows, I think I can do anyone's job. So there is this level of, okay, it might be biology, but it is most certainly more about how society has taught you what as a woman, the things that you should be, you know, don't try to intimidate other people. You it's not your place to be too loudmouth or open about how you feel. And even I have experienced this where I asked a lot of questions once to this person and he said, you just looked a bit confused. And I was like, but I wasn't. I knew exactly why I was asking. But then someone else who was also asking questions, he was like, oh my God, I loved how curious and creative you are. And that just shows that he was asking dumb questions, to be honest. But it's just the perception that people have of you is different. And then the perception you have of yourself is different based on what you have imbibed from society. So I think it's tough to say that it's just the gender. It's just the biology behind. It's also a lot of other things that come into play that we're trying to wean off.
Hmm. Okay. So some people would argue that if you look at the most egalitarian societies, you'd find them in the Scandinavian countries,
mm-hmm.
who have taken more steps than any other nation to try and combat gender inequality and stuff, and try and remove all of the barriers that hold people back, and sort of society is very equal and people can kind of do what they want.
Mm-hmm.
Those people would say that in those societies, you actually get a more pronounced skewing of women towards caring professions and men towards engineering-y type professions,
mm-hmm.
despite all of the inroads that the society has tried to do
mm-hmm.
their very best to combat all of the societal and all the different barriers in place.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say that if you look at certain studies that have mapped the progress of this, you would expect to see at least some correction, but actually you expect what you see is a more skewing towards the extremes. Those people might argue that, well, you know, if those societies were to say, no, we need to have 50% of engineers be women, that would require tyrannical sort of levels of control to kind of make that happen. Do you not see this as a sort of not quite agreeing with your philosophy that if there is not equality of outcome, then there is a problem?
Right. So two things about this.
Hmm.
The first thing is change doesn't happen over a short time. I think change like this will take more than one person's lifetime. So I don't think that even though the Scandinavian countries might have tried to remove the barriers, but the change will not happen very soon. I think it will take some time for these things to actually change mindsets and change, you know, because the people who are older, they will go through the system the same, and it's the new generation that will follow. So it takes time to get the changes. So that's one thing. And the second thing is, I think it's fine. Again, I'm a strong believer of choice. So it's fine if women think that they would rather do these kind of like people's job.
Mm.
Fine. But they got the choice, right? And there was no barrier to them. They've been exposed to everything and then they make their choices. So that's absolutely fine. But then you can't, because this country, you kind of know, in inverted brackets, right, that, you know, they kind of tried to remove the barriers. So let's say it has been an equal opportunity here. So then I wouldn't care about the outcome because everyone did what they wanted. But then in other places where this is not the case, then the outcome is a result of that. So then it's hard to compare these two different situations.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And presumably you aren't campaigning for more women to be in prison.
But there are female prisons. I don't know why you're saying there are more just men in prisons.
I'm saying the vast majority of...
Yeah.
Like I could say, well, there are female CEOs.
Yeah, I agree.
And that's not a...
I agree. Yes.
Okay, so it sounds like we're agreed that...
Oh, no, we just want no men in prisons either. We just want all the prisons closed.
That would be nice. Yeah, I agree. There was a good episode of Reasons to be Cheerful, which is Ed Miliband's podcast.
Okay.
Where they interviewed, like, the guy who handles the prison system in, like, Sweden.
Okay.
Compared to, like, the prison system in America. And it's so drastically different. It's insane.
Yeah, but there's a new Netflix show about this. Like, the harshest prisons in the world. And one of them is the Mauritian prison.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I didn't even know this was a thing, but yeah. And then this guy,
if you were a guy, you would have done. I'm kidding.
Wow. This guy who was in prison, I think, in Spain.
Yeah.
So he's the main guy in the documentary. And then he goes and spends a week in each of these prisons as a prisoner.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that sounds like pretty good content.
He interacts with them. Yeah, we should watch it. The Mauritian prison one, you can watch it.
Yeah, man, let's do it.
Yeah.
It sounds like it would be fun. I think that is a good note to end the conversation on. Any final things you'd like to say?
listen to my podcast. It's going to be fun. I have a lot of interesting people lined up. We have space people, we have athletes, we have scientists, we have doctors, we have people who've got £1 million in investment in their startup. So it's going to be really, really cool. And I hope you enjoy it. And if you know someone cool who can be on the podcast, let me know.
Amazing. Thanks for listening, everyone. And in future, all the voices you hear on this podcast are going to be women. So
that's a win. Thank you, Ali, that's for being the only male voice.
For female empowerment.
Great. Thank you.